Hi, this is Patrick Cox in the World Newsroom in Boston, and you're listening to The World in Words number 23, and happy Endangered Languages Month. I just made that thing up about Endangered Languages Month, but that is the subject of today's podcast. We'll also be checking in on some fantastically creative words, words not easily rendered into English.
My favorite word still is the six-letter Persian word, nakur, and it means a camel that won't give milk until her nostrils are tickled.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know.
Thank you, Borat. The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can hear The Big Show on more than 250 public radio stations. Today, we're taking a global tour of endangered languages. But don't worry, it won't all be granola-munching, super-nutritious public radio style. I have fretted before about this infatuation that public radio has with endangered languages. Check out The World in Words number 4 for that. But, you know, the funny thing is that now that I'm ever so slightly educated on this, I find myself actually liking endangered language issues. And now even I think there's a way to talk about them without relying on public radio clichés. We haven't got there yet, so please consider this podcast to be something of a transition from the old ways to the new ways. I think actually you'll hear that as today's edition progresses. Okay, enough pomposity. On today's cast, we start with a US-funded attempt to revive a mountain language in Central Asia. And then it's a chat with Mr. Endangered Languages himself, Peter Austin. And finally, we hear about some fabulously original words in a bunch of other languages. Stick around for that. It's a real treat. First off, shugni. I know, sounds like some toxic sugar substitute. But no, it's a language spoken in the Pamir Mountains. And where are they? Well, Tom Goodell of WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, is here to tell you.
Here's how shugni sounds.
Murders bashande nam bagaras zolchomor Yusuf istemistase denyo ichayas nisbakor.
Shugni is spoken by about 60,000 people in Tajikistan and Afghanistan. Like many endangered languages, it's spoken more by the old than the young, and it has no written tradition. Gulnoro Mirzavafoyeva is a linguist from Tajikistan who grew up speaking shugni.
This is something that we should not lose, because this is something that we value. It's not that we don't have that word in shugni. We do have. And if it continues like this, there is a kind of possibility for language to be lost.
Mirzavafoyeva's mission to save her language brought her to the University of Kentucky on a U.S. government program. There she met linguistics professor Jean Marie Rouillet-Willoughby.
On the list of biographical information I received was that she was a native speaker of shugni, which I immediately thought, I've never heard that language. I'm going to investigate. So once we started finding out more about the language, we discovered that it was undocumented and in need of not only documentation, but to some extent protection.
The official language of Tajikistan is Tajik. Russian is also widely spoken. Those are the languages of instruction, of business, and of TV and radio. People speak shugni at home, and Gulnoro Mirzavafoyeva says even she, a linguist, can't remember all the shugni words she once knew.
Now I have so many words that I use from Russian language, and I forgot the shugni words for that. But the old people, they use less Russian words.
There are many languages in a similar state of collapse, including several others in the Pamir Mountain region of Central Asia. Many of these endangered languages have a claim to their own uniqueness. That's the case with shugni too, says University of Kentucky linguist Andrew Hipsley.
One particular area that we're interested in is the verb system. Throughout the life of us, we still cannot puzzle out exactly what's going on. They have all the irregular and regularity problems that we have. They also have a strange agreement system in their verbs. They decide who the subject is of the sentence. They do it one way if it's the present tense, and they do it a completely different way if it's the past tense.
It may follow wildly different grammatical patterns, says Hipsley, but shugni has more in common with English than you might think.
Because shugni is at some point related to English, way, 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 way back when. Yes, it's part of Indo-European. We're discovering all sorts of similar-sounding words. Like, for example, a few days ago, we were talking about the word weave. And the word weave is our word for knit. And it's not a coincidence. At one point, Shugni and English speakers at the same time were both saying we, meaning more or less the same thing.
And ultimately, that's all these linguists can do. Document the characteristics and grammatical tics of this language before it vanishes. For The World, this is Tom Goodell in Lexington, Kentucky.
Okay, on to Peter Austin. He's director of the Endangered Languages Program at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He and I talked this week about how languages are documented, how they're saved, and in some cases, how they're not saved. First, I asked him about an article he wrote for the British newspaper The Guardian, in which he identified 10 languages that are particularly imperiled. Here's Peter Austin.
The Guardian asked me to sort of choose my top 10 endangered languages because they have this top 10 feature that authors contribute towards. They asked me to do 10, and I thought, my God, how can I possibly choose 10 out of 3,000 languages that are threatened? So what I did was tried to choose languages from most continents, and I wanted to choose ones that would really give people a sense of what it's like to speak a language where your community is under threat and pressure from a bigger language, a language that's, you know, more powerful and stronger, and also a sense of what is lost when a language is no longer spoken, when it's no longer passed on to the next generation. So I chose some languages that have, you know, some very unusual features that are historically really significant in the hope that it would give a kind of perspective on what's happening around the world.
Right, and one of those languages is one that I will not try to pronounce, but it gave the world the word kangaroo.
Yes, it's called Gugu Yimidir, and it's spoken, there are about 200 people who speak it today. It's spoken around the town of Cooktown in northern Queensland. And Cooktown, of course, takes its name from James Cook, the English explorer.
And you're an Australian Aboriginal specialist yourself. How many of these languages do you yourself speak?
Well, I've been doing research on Australian languages now for over 30 years. I started as an undergraduate student working on a language there. And I've recorded material from about 12 different languages in Australia.
Oh, my goodness. And how, in those moments when you're trying to find out more about how the language works and you're doing this field work, how do you communicate?
Well, usually you begin with people who are bilingual. In addition to Australia, I've also done research in the eastern part of Indonesia. I began working with people who could speak some English and also speak Indonesian. And now the research that I do is essentially monolingual. I know enough of the Sasak language that I'm working on that I can, you know, ask them questions in Sasak and they can discuss things or tell me stories or we can talk about particular aspects of the culture and the society and the language.
And Sasak, that is spoken by how many people?
Sasak has about 2 million speakers, but it's essentially, it's only a spoken language. It's spoken on the island of Lombok, which is just to the east of Bali in Indonesia. Everything in terms of people's external life, their social life, the education, politics, everything in the Lombok is done in Indonesian. So nobody writes in Sasak. Nobody would send an email in Sasak. Nobody would go to a government office and speak in Sasak because it's the language that people speak at home, in the family, out in the villages, in the rural district. But the language of the city, the language of education, the language of jobs and politics is Bahasa Indonesia.
Right. It sounds like a classic example of the threats to a minority language, even in this particular case where it's spoken by a large number of people.
Indeed. And the issue that usually happens with endangered languages is that people have a negative evaluation of their own language. They say it's not worth continuing to speak it. You know, you can't write it down. It's only a dialect. It's only something that we speak at home. It's not a proper language. It hasn't got all the vocabulary that, you know, big important languages have. Lots of these kind of negative stereotypes. And once you get that belief system in place, it's very easy then for people to say, well, let's talk to our children in Bahasa Indonesia or in English or in Spanish or Portuguese or whatever they see as the dominant, more powerful language.
How do you make the argument against that? I mean, presumably there are people telling you, people who are often extremely poor, and they're telling you that we really want to create the best opportunities for our children, and therefore it's important that they do speak more of a major language. Right. What do you say?
Well, that's absolutely correct. But you can be bilingual or trilingual or multilingual. It's a case of saying, well, you can add this to your existing knowledge. It's an additive bilingualism. Too often people tend to think, well, it somehow has to be subtractive, you know. We can't speak Welsh anymore. We have to speak English to our kids so they'll get jobs. So let's stop speaking Welsh. I mean, this was the view here in the UK, you know, in the 1950s and early 60s. And people sort of had this idea that there's some problem if you happen to be bilingual, if you maintain and converse in two languages, in two different contexts, in two different situations. But that's simply false. You know, it's a powerful message to try and get across, which is it's wonderful to add languages to your repertoire, and you don't have to lose out in the process.
That's very interesting. I mean, you raised Welsh, which is often cited as a successful example of government investment and, you know, really turning around the popularity of a language, including in the schools. How have they done that? Have they managed to also include, say, French or Spanish or Chinese as choices for second languages as well as Welsh, just in order that the people there are given as many sort of global opportunities as school kids in England?
Well, everybody in, more or less everybody in Wales these days is bilingual, because even children who are in Welsh immersion schools are still learning English. So the two languages are, you know, co-equally being developed. It wasn't just the government that was involved in this. It was a huge commitment from the Welsh-speaking community themselves. And, you know, a government can tell people, well, you should speak this language, and they can repeatedly say it, but it won't be successful unless the community says there is a reason to want to do this. You know, there are reasons in terms of our identity to preserve our culture and our language and the stories and the history and the songs. I mean, particularly in the case of Welsh, you have the incredibly rich literature and songs and so on that, you know, that was what people wanted to carry forward. If you, say, take the case of Irish, on the other hand, you know, the Irish government has been telling people, forcing people, in fact, to study Irish at school for a very long period of time, but with relatively limited success because of differences in the socio-politics of the Irish language in Ireland as against the Welsh language in Wales. And also, you know, learning Welsh is not going to then prevent you from, say, studying French or German or Japanese or anything else.
Once you do have the will of the people to preserve the language, is there a right way for government support, for government intervention, if you like?
Well, there are various models that people have been trying around the world. The term for the process that we often use is revitalization. And it can be everything from national recognition as a language. Take the case of Maori, for example, in New Zealand. Now Maori is recognized as one of the two national languages of New Zealand. You know, all legislation that comes out of the parliament is published in Maori and in English. It's achieving recognition at a kind of national level was a very important political aspect for them. But on the other hand, there are activities that can only be done locally by the community members themselves. And again, in the Maori case, they established what they called kōhanga reo, which literally means language nests. Kōhanga is nest and reo is language. And these were preschools that were set up in which children, you know, 2-3-year-olds, were looked after in a daycare situation by adults, usually the grandparent generation, who were charged with only speaking Maori to the children. So the kids' parents might only speak English at home, but they wanted them to learn some Maori, so they put them in this language nest environment for several years, where they were only exposed to speaking Maori in the language nest, and then later went through primary school and secondary school. So you have a mixture of direct government involvement in terms of political recognition combined together with local grassroots activities by communities themselves. And the most successful instances we have around the world of this kind of revitalization is where you get both things happening. The case of Welsh that we mentioned already, the Maori case, Hawaiian in Hawaii, you know, there now has thousands of children speaking it, whereas a generation ago it was really struggling.
Well, Peter Austin, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Nice to speak to you.
Peter Austin has published 11 books on languages, including one just out that he edited. It's called 1,000 Languages. It's a gorgeously illustrated book full of all kinds of interesting tidbits and not especially academic. Here's another book you might quite like, The Meaning of Toujours Tingo and Other Extraordinary Words to Change the Way We See the World, by Adam Jacko de Buono. Now, in this book, you'll find all kinds of strange words and phrases in Japanese, Persian, Norwegian, and also in languages like Ulwa and Tulu. So anyway, Adam and the world's Marco Woman played a little game with our listeners on The Big Show, trying to match words with the countries and languages they came from. Here's Marco.
The first one is porinkansema.
It means the distance equal to how far a reindeer can travel without taking a comfort break, and it comes from Finland, so the language is Finnish. The other one is virtually impossible for anyone, in fairness, and hanyauku, meaning to walk on tiptoe on warm sand, is strictly speaking from the Rukwengali language of Namibia, though I think southern Africa would count as a success.
Now, Adam, the title of your book is Extraordinary Words to Change the Way We See the World. Do you really think words can change the way we see the world?
Unquestionably. I mean, I don't mean it to be too grand a claim, but certainly they highlight individual aspects of cultures. I mean, we're not always going to, you know, as English speakers, going to share the same cultural climates, and therefore we won't have the 108 words that the Hawaiians have for sweet potato, nor will we have lovely words like dinky, the Norwegian word for the act of dunking someone's face in snow. But actually, where it's really interesting,
dinky.
I think, yeah, dinky, where I think it's interesting is that actually, you know, despite our difference in differing sort of circumstances, the words very much reveal the commonality of human experience remains strong. I just want to encourage the survival of some of these rare and wonderful languages. I mean, they're tragically, you know, they're becoming extinct at the rate of one a fortnight.
Let's just go over a couple more examples here, because there are some real good ones here.
Well, there's some lovely ones. Womba from Cameroon, meaning the smiling in sleep by children. You know, English is a strong language, but it doesn't have words for every sentiment, as it were.
I want you to tell me about another word, the Italian word baffona.
If I remember right, it means a mustachioed woman.
A woman with a mustache. But there's a nuance to it, too, that the woman is attractive.
I mean, one looks at lots of these lovely words. There's a wonderful word, kibitz, from Germany, meaning an onlooker at a card game who interferes with unwanted advice.
Is there a word that for you really seems to sum up kind of how these phrases, these expressions, really seem to kind of epitomize the nations that they're from?
Well, my first finding that the Albanians had 27 words for eyebrow and 27 words for moustache. But I also think pelinti, the Ghana word, because this is a sentiment we all have, and pelinti means to move very hot food around inside one's mouth in order to avoid too close a contact. Pelinti.
That's a great word. And so is a food spicy or is it temperature hot?
The dictionary says very hot food, and so we're left to consider it as that. I mean, I don't always, this is the point of the book, is it's enough to declare the fun. I mean, there's this lovely word mbwe from Venda in South Africa, and it means a round pebble taken from a crocodile's stomach and swallowed by a chief. And the whole point is to leave it at that and then allow the reader's imagination to think in what possible context a word like that might apply.
In gathering these words, collecting these words, you travel a lot with a tape recorder and...
I haven't. No, I've read, and I say read, I have combed every single word of over 600 dictionaries. And it might seem like a very strange pursuit, but the great thing is that every 5 or 10 pages you come across some wonderful word. My favorite word still is the six-letter Persian word, nakur, and it means a camel that won't give milk until her nostrils are tickled. English is a great language, but... You shouldn't be surprised that there are many, many others. And in this multinational, multicultural age, we should be celebrating the joy and diversity of all that languages offer.
Adam Jacques de Buono's book is titled Toujours Tingo, Extraordinary Words to Change the Way We See the World. Well, what language would you like me to say goodbye and the best of luck to you in?
Any language you like that isn't English.
Ankyute, Uye, Erive, Uchme.
Ciao.
Now that's entertainment. Linguistic entertainment, but entertainment nonetheless. And here's a question. Do you think I should start a regular segment in this podcast of difficult-to-translate foreign words along the lines of what we just heard? Let me know. The future content of this podcast is in your hands. Message me on Facebook or post a comment on the Facebook group The World in Words. If you use email, I know email is just so 1990s. Anyways, my address is language@pri.org. Also, I should say that Adam Jacko de Buono has another book out that's cheaper and easier to find than Toujours Tingo. It's called The Meaning of Tingo. It's the first Tingo book. Okay, that's it for this week. I think that next week it may be time to speak some Spanglish. See you then.